Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 161st of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm FNH. Today we're starting off with the next part of a battalion history, then we'll move into the musical number, and then on to the eighth part of The Wrong Side of the Tracks by T.C. McQueen. Let's get started. Second phase. Early in December, it was known that the next tour was to be once more in the Salient. On the 17th of December, the battalion entrained at Sternwerk for Poppingi, and from where it marched to Dickbush huts, which were always remembered as being built on islands in a sea of mud. The following night, another march via Kruerstraat and Zilbeki brought the men to Maple Copse, where they relieved the 11th Royal Scots, the 9th Division. The trenches were found to consist of holes and ditches, which were worked on till they were quite good and dry. It was here that arrangements were first made for the prevention of trench foot. Sunday, the 19th of December, was marked by a German gas attack north of Hooge, but the battalion was not involved. The following day, the artillery activity continued, and Lieutenant Colonel Jeffries was wounded whilst going round a new piece of the line which had been taken over from the Argyll and Southern Highlanders. Major G.A. Stevens, the 8th DLI, took over command, and the following day Captain R.B. Bradford, afterwards Brigadier General Bradford, V.C., joined as adjutant. An unusual occurrence took place on the 22nd of December, when two Russians who had been prisoners in Germany had been working behind the line, escaped and came into the trenches in the battalion sector. On Christmas Day, the battalion was out of the line and in the huts at Dickybush. Captain Bradford left on the 31st of December to join the 7th Battalion and was succeeded as adjutant by 2nd Lieutenant C.E. Yaldwin. On New Year's morning, the battalion had its first experience of a really heavy British bombardment of the enemy's trenches. The bombardment was so intense that it was possible to find one's way about Sanctuary Wood by the light of the gun flashes. The only other incident of importance in that first month of 1916 was the departure of the machine gun section under which 2nd Lieutenant L. Brock was sent to form part of the Brigade Machine Gun Company. To replace the guns, the 1st Lewis guns were issued and put under the command of the 2nd Lieutenant J.P. Moffat. It was also about this time that the battalion journal, the Whizbang, came into existence, edited and run by 2nd Lieutenant Yaldwin. Its illustrations by Captain Catford and articles were much appreciated, but unfortunately its publication ceased in November of the same year. Throughout January and February there were local artillery combats, which terminated with the capture of Hill 60 and The Bluff. On the 1st of March, there was a demonstration at 5 p.m, which consisted of artillery and infantry fire and cheering as if for an attack. The following morning at 4:32 a.m, the 3rd Division attacked and captured International and New Year trenches and The Bean with over 200 prisoners. On the 18th of March, the battalion was relieved and moved to Poppingi by train from Ypres. 4 days later, it returned again by train and took over the recently captured Bluff trenches from the 10th Royal Welsh Fusiliers, 3rd Division. These trenches were round the edge of the Bluff crater and were in a very bad condition due to the rain and heavy shelling, and were littered with the remnants of German equipment and their dead. X Company were on the right in the New Year trench, supported by Y Company in Gordon Post. W Company were in the centre in The Loop, and Z Company on the left in The Bean. On the 27th of March at 4:15 a.m, the 3rd Division on the right attacked at St. Eloy, and during the attack the medical officer, Captain White, and a party of stretcher bearers rendered valuable assistance. A few days later, the 2nd of April, the battalion was relieved by the Canadians, who had suffered heavily from shell fire in coming up, and moved again to Dickybush, where there was a stay of 2 days before moving south to the Scottish lines at Wetoutre and Le Clyde. A week later, on the 8th of April, the battalion was again in the line, this time relieving the 7th Battalion Shropshire Light Infantry in trenches N and O in front of Wachati and the back area of La Clyde. These trenches were of the breastwork type. About this time there was a good deal of fighting on the left, where the Germans were trying to retake St. Eloi Craters. On the 24th of April the battalion was relieved and marched to rest billets at Berthun. These billets were found to be farms scattered over a large area. A few days after arrival, Lieutenant Colonel Jeffries, DSO, returned and took over command from Lieutenant Colonel Stevens, who went as Brigade Major to a Canadian brigade. Early on the morning of the 30th, the battalion was roused by the news of a gas attack, but after standing to till daylight, it was not required to move. A week later, 2nd Lieutenant G. Kirkhouse was appointed adjutant in place of 2nd Lieutenant Yaldwin, and on the 8th of May, the battalion returned to La Clyde for 4 days' working parties. The only other incidents of importance during May were an inspection by Sir Douglas Haig and the farewell inspection and address on the 16th by Brigadier General Shear prior to his departure to take over command of the 30th Division, and he was succeeded by Brigadier General Westmoreland. On the 28th of May, the battalion returned to the trenches it had left a month before, and on the 2nd of June the men were able to watch the German attack between Hill 60 and Hooge and the Canadian counterattack on the following day. Lieutenant Ebsworth, MC, DCM, East Lancashire Regiment, joined as adjutant on the 7th of June. During this tour, the 1st Battalion raid was made by men of Y Company under 2nd Lieutenant H.C. Arnett and 2nd Lieutenant J.F.G. Aubin, who was the battalion bombing officer. The party consisted of 24 men, including 2 bombing squads, and had as its object identification of the enemy on the immediate front. The night of the 6th of June was chosen, and the party went out as arranged. In no man's land, they met a large enemy wiring party, and their object was not attained. 3 nights later, however, a German was captured, and again on the 12th, the raiding party went out, this time with the object of killing Boches. They entered the enemy trench, and after doing considerable damage with bombs and rifles, returned without a casualty. Apart from these incidents, the sector was on the whole quiet, except for a certain amount of sniping. The principal feature was the daily enemy bombardment with trench mortars, which lasted from 1 to 3 hours, and on occasions was very heavy. The front line, however, was thinly held, and very few casualties resulted. After receiving 2 drafts, one of 190 and another of 110 men respectively, the battalion was relieved on the 7th of August by the 7th Battalion, the King's Own, and moved to its old billets at Berthun. This ended the second phase of its war history, and a few days later, it moved south to the Somme area. Today's music is by Arthur Fields. It's a wartime piece called Let's Bury the Hatchet, but Arthur seems to have created a rather new meaning for that phrase.
Away to fight the German foe. The pacifists are shouting peace and say they shouldn't go. They claim the hatchet must be buried by the Allies now. Perhaps they're right, we must have peace. And so I'll tell them how. Let's bury the hatchet. Let's bury the hatchet. Let's bury the hatchet in the Kaiser's head. We'll crown him on the noodle, make him whistle Yankee Doodle, shouting the battle cry of Wilson. Let's bury the hatchet, let's bury the hatchet in the Kaiser's head. We'll crown him on the noodle, make him whistle Yankee Doodle, shouting the battle cry of Wilson. War, and then we'll get his goat. We'll chop them into frankfurters and dump them down his throat. We'll chase him out of Russia, then we'll try another stunt. We'll punch him in the Belgium and smash his Western Front. Let's bury the hatchet, let's bury the hatchet, let's bury the hatchet in the Kaiser's head. When Berlin is in ashes, we'll burn up his big mustaches, shouting the battle cry of Wilson. Let's bury the hatchet, let's bury the hatchet, let's bury the hatchet in the Kaiser's head. We'll prove to him and his curse we don't fight like bossy whiskers, shouting the battle cry of Wilson.
And after that rather bloodthirsty music, now on to today's main feature. This is the eighth part of The Wrong Side of the Tracks by T.C. McQueen. Chapter 8. All by Myself. The large round buried itself in his bloodless skull. The arcane etchings on the bullet went to work, burning him from the inside out. In a moment, he was aflame, roaring in disbelief and anger. The others shied away from the brilliant blue fire that consumed him. In seconds, he was reduced to a pile of ash. Although the results were impressive, the math was against me. I had 5 rounds left in the gun. Another 6 of the handmade rounds sat on my belt. The remainder of the spare rounds I carried with me were either silver-tipped or hollow points. Sure, I had more shells in my luggage, but that was somewhere on the train. Might as well have been on a neighbouring planet. The crowd surged forwards, so I ran like hell. With an energy derived from adrenaline supplemented heavily with fear, I hurdled piles of broken machinery and sprinted up the stairs 2 at a time, retracing my steps back to the office. I managed to steel myself into pausing long enough to barricade the door with a desk and some empty filing cabinet, before continuing my headlong flight out of the fire door and down the fire escape, which groaned in protest at my heavy footsteps crashing down it. Halfway down, the bolt sheared from the wall, and the damn thing pitched outwards, tipping me onto the grass. I managed to half-roll, old wounds murmuring in protest as I scrabbled to my feet and kept running, hugging the building line. The scream of tortured metal echoed behind me, mixed with the angry roars of my pursuers. I reached the end of the building and risked a glance back. The collapse of the stairway had thinned the herd, but I still had 6 or 7 on my trail. In the open, I would eventually tire and these guys would be on me, so I opted to head further into town, hoping to lose them in the abandoned sprawl of Seward's Ridge. I took a couple of quick turns before throwing myself under a fertilizer truck sat on the curbside. I tried to control my breathing, fearful the hammering heartbeat in my chest would give me away. Heavy footsteps thundered past my hiding place as I clutched my revolver. With only 5 precious rounds left, I would have to make them count. As I lay there, taking in my surroundings, something caught my eye. A flicker of light, nothing more, just a faint flicker. I tried to concentrate on the source. A nondescript warehouse marked Go Lane Machinery seemed to be swimming in and out of focus. A light within winked softly in the gloom. Harriet had told us that the power was down. Against my better judgment, I decided to check it out. The warehouse had been surrounded by a 12-foot wall topped with broken glass. I say had been. It looked like someone had driven a tank through it. Brickwork lay scattered across the yard, and the yard gate was smashed like matchwood. Strangely, though, the warehouse appeared intact. Checking the coast was clear, I trotted over to the smashed gate. The building just didn't look right. Something indefinable just set off an alarm in my head somewhere, as being wrong. I drew closer, reaching a tentative hand out to the door. To my surprise, my hand passed straight through it. I yanked my hand back, quickly checking it was none the worse for the wear. What the hell had I found? I tried again, and again my hand slid straight through. This time, I was aware of a faint tickle of an electric charge pulling on the hairs on the back of my hand. I took a leap of faith and stepped through the illusion. I'm not sure what I expected to find, but the reality was much weirder. I found myself standing at the base of a flight of black metal stairs. Looking up, I could see they formed part of a gantry, maybe 40 foot square, raised 10 feet off of the ground. The platform had been a control room of some kind, filled with alien equipment, large screens and controls for God only knows what. I say had been. The place was wrecked, equipment smashed, a metal framework twisted and pulled apart, as if a tornado of mental patients had spiralled through. Whoever had trashed the walls outside had barreled straight through here. Then I saw the bodies. Dismembered arms and legs lay strewn amongst the shattered equipment. I caught glimpses of business suit and leather shoes. These remains were not human, however. Closer examination showed strange alien flesh clad in the human clothing. I wished the doc was here for the alien autopsy portion of the day's entertainment. I took a guess that this was what was left of the grey suits' visitors. Migo, dressed up as people. Damn, those guys were getting the knack of that. Not that their disguise did them any good, however. From the platform, the outside world was easily visible. The walls of the warehouse were damn near transparent. A hologram of some kind. Bayliss would have had a field day with this type of technology. This was, or had been, till recently, some kind of surveillance operation. The remains of a screen lay in ruins, a portion still displaying a distorted image of the city hall and the town square. It showed a fleeting glimpse of a large crowd of locals moving past the view of the camera. I cleared away some of the wreckage, hoping to get a better look. My interference must have done more harm than good. The image flickered and died. A sound behind me had me spinning in place, gun in hand. The far corner of the platform held the wreckage of 6 tall, transparent tubes. I crept closer, stepping over the debris and bodies. Close up, the stench was awful. The first 5 tubes held nothing but a rank dissolved biomass. The last, however, held something suspended by hooks. Its pale skin was held apart, displaying the thing's innards. An obscene-looking creature, in appearance like a jellyfish maybe 6 feet tall, with grey translucent skin. It hung there, inert, like some grotesque catch of the day. Tubes ran from the thing's body to a device of some kind, and then a large bell jar half full of clear green fluid. I heard the sound again. I leapt back, levelling the pistol. I stood dumbstruck with revulsion as the tubes detached from the body with a loud sigh. Some unseen machinery triggered, bathing the tube in blue light, melting the remains into a stinking mass like the other containers. I used my cell to take some pictures. I knew my powers of description wouldn't be up to the task. I suddenly remembered the image on the screen, and the realization struck me. I'd left the doc to fend for himself with a supernatural lynch mob roaming the streets. I headed back out onto the sidewalk, hoping to run interference for my old friend. Pausing to get my bearings, I set a rough course for the town square, guided by the looming presence of the clock tower. I ran from cover to cover, wary of every open door and vacant window. I glanced round a corner to catch a glimpse of a crowd of infected gathered round something large and silver. I took a second look and found myself staring at the wreckage of the escalade lying on its side, tyres still spinning. A mob of snarling townsfolk were tearing at the SUV with their bare hands. As I watched, the crowd ripped out the doors, dragged the occupants from within. A terrible tearing sound rang across the street as the car's occupants shed their human skin like the Hulk bursting from his lab coat. The infected were briefly cowed by the sudden transformation as the Migo spread their wings and drew weapons. I ducked as shots from the Migo heat gun sliced overhead. Wild shots felled a couple of the attackers, but a dozen filled their place and pressed forward, clawing at these shooters. The roar of the crowd became mixed with the high-pitched screeches as they tore off wings and wrenched limbs from bodies. I made full use of the crowd's preoccupation with their bug problem and sprinted across the junction. I kept running, my mind replaying the images of the infected tearing those bugs apart. I didn't imagine this old Texan would fare any better in their hands. When I passed the gas station, I began to recognize my surroundings from our first foray into the town. As I crouched by an abandoned car, I heard a familiar voice hiss at me from the shadows. "Help me carry this stuff. It weighs a bloody ton." The red-faced academic peered at me from behind a low wall. I joined him in his hiding place, scooping up the tool bag, and we set off again. "Doc, I found a Migo duck blind about a block and a half away from the abattoir. The infected had trashed it, killed all of them. I saw a glimpse of a big crowd on their surveillance system near to the town hall. Glad you didn't run into it." "I saw it. I saw it. The mob moved as with one mind. I believe they're taking direction from the Hostroth itself," he enthused, a little too much white showing in his eyes for comfort. "We really need to document this properly. Let's go back into town and find the mob again." I placed a restraining hand on his arm. "Doc, we really need to fix the damn train and get those citizens out of here before the beastie has them for lunch," I gently reminded him. "Ah, yes, the passengers, of course, you're right," he admitted grudgingly. He still had that look in his eye that told me he would sooner stick around here and study this monstrous creature and its human petting zoo instead. Well, that's it for today. The opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project, and this file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk.